again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Opening this Friday at the Milwaukee Art Museum, Thomas Sully painted performance. He was one of the most important 19th century American artists, and this is the first retrospective of his work in 30 years, a long time. It includes nearly 80 paintings from public and private collections and presents them thematically. KP and I had a chance to preview the exhibit yesterday, and I must tell you the truth, I didn't know very much about Thomas Sully, but I was just captivated by his paintings, the color and the theatricality of it. They are just terrific. If you like portrait painting at all, and one of our guests actually worked at the Smithsonian, which I didn't know. I love that museum as well, but they are absolutely gorgeous portraits and historical. He was one of the 19th century's most prolific artists, painting over, this is amazing, 2,300 works during a career that spans 70 years. So it is our great delight to have the co-curators of the exhibit with us in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee this hour. William Rudolph is with us. He's been with us before. He is Dudley Godfrey Jr., curator of American art and decorative arts and director of exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum. He told us when he was last here that he had been working on this project for 8 years. Is that right, William?
Yes, unbelievably.
It's a long time.
It's a long gestation.
Yeah, but there is so much to it, and I can see your enthusiasm for him. I just really, to be honest, didn't know much about him, and the paintings are absolutely beautiful. Just, it's a great exhibit.
Thank you so much, and it's largely due to my great co-curator who's sitting to my right.
Oh, it's because of you too, William, I'm sure. Carol Eaton Soltis is a project associate curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art Center for American Art, and she is the co-curator of the Thomas Sully exhibit, and she did work at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington some time ago. And thank you, Carol, so much for being with us and for taking us on the lovely tour yesterday.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So, Thomas Sully, why is it that this, of all the painters in the whole wide world, why did you decide to devote so much time and want to resurrect his work? What is it about him personally that's so captivating? Carol?
Well, he's quite important in the history of American painting. Everyone studies, has to come across him and study him, but he's been looked at, you know, virtually only as a portraitist, and he painted a large number of subject pictures, in other words, pictures that came from literature and other theatrical kinds of subjects. And as we began, we both like these subject pictures, fancy pictures. We wanted to know more about them, and they've been kind of shunted aside in the literature. Nobody's been caring about them, and the fact that they were so important to Sully, we thought was an interesting thing. And that's what we started to learn more and more about. And as we did, we realized that there was a real interaction between those pictures and Sully's portraiture, and that they also helped him stay afloat professionally by being a source of income and a source of experimentation technically for him. So they were deeply enmeshed. So we were looking at him in a broader way than he's ever been looked at before. So it's a new way of looking at Sully, so both traditionally and adding on to
so you had to dig probably to find some of the paintings that are there.
They're just not widely distributed.
Oh, yes. We dug. Carol and I both love colonial and federal American art. We like to joke that we are among the maybe eight people on the planet who are American art curators who love this period, and we both love portraiture. And what's been personally very interesting about the project to me is that it has stretched me as a curator, because I've been changing my opinion of Sully, not just as a portraitist, but also as a subject painter. And as Carol said, you can't separate the two. So it's been quite an enjoyable process for me to reimagine what I thought I knew about the 19th century.
Let's bring, let's just start with this simply because some people won't know who he is. They'll be like me, not know very much about him. But if I say the name Andrew Jackson, you can associate Andrew Jackson with Thomas Sully because
he's on the $20 bill in Sully's portrait. And that's the kind of high profile individual he painted. He painted the young Queen Victoria right as she's ascending to the throne, literally and figuratively. And so he was really the painter to the glamorous people of the day, but he also painted, you know, throughout his career, people of all levels who were looking to have portraits painted. And he painted very large life-size paintings, small vignette-type paintings, 25 by 30 size portraits. So he did whatever the market would bear, whatever was needed. He was very much, as William and I keep reiterating, a working painter. And as part of the interest of his career is the fact of how we've been looking at how he was making a living and how he was pushing at different kinds of things at times when the portrait business was not so good. Then he was doing other things. And it's really the more we learn about him over time, the more interesting this is going to become, I think, in the aspect of how you are an artist. And I think that's one very interesting aspect of the research that has come out of it and will develop. Hopefully other people will latch on to aspects of things that we have brought to the surface and run with these different parts
of it. Let's talk about theater and the importance of theater in his life, because they're not just portraits. As you pointed out yesterday, you're actively engaged with these people. It's like you've caught them in the middle of a scene or in the middle of a conversation with somebody. Most portraits are pretty staid and there's the face, but there's another element in his work.
Right. There's multiple ideas of theatricality in Sully's work. And at the very basic, there is the fact that Sully had a lifelong relationship with the theater because he was the child of working actors. He himself was trained for the stage, and his first commissions were of actors and actresses, some of whom were in their signature roles, and those were his first great public successes. Sully became a celebrity portraitist for the 19th century, and he initially did it by painting celebrities. Yeah. Thanks to these familial connections to the world of the theater, that is probably the most literal meaning of it. But there are other more suggestive meanings of theatricality as well.
Yeah, as you say about these gestures that you see in his paintings, the sort of dynamism of the way he presents a personality. We have examples in the exhibition where he's doing a Fanny Kemble. She's as Beatrice in Much Ado About Nothing, a Shakespearean scene. And so she's in this character. But we have her bracketed on either side by portraits of Rebecca Gratz, who is a Philadelphian, a very high-profile, very intelligent woman, and she's shown both painted in 1831 in the same year, but in very different aspects of her personality. So he took this theatricality, these characters that he were depicting, and he could inject them into people's portraits, the people that lived around him in Philadelphia, and showed different qualities of these people, different aspects. So he dramatized real life. Then.
And some of these people weren't sitting in front of him. They were in his mind, right?
Well, that's specifically the case in some of the portraits he did of the actress Frances Anne or Fanny Kemble. Uh-huh. He knew her very closely, very well. She was a very intimate friend of the family. And he had painted her from life, but he also created images of her from memory of her most important roles at the time. And you'll see three of them side by side in the exhibition. And then you'll also see a portrait done from life in a later section of the exhibition. We know that this kind of memory evocation, this theatrical remembrance of Fanny, is true in that case. The rest of his portrait practice was just as you might imagine, someone in front of him as a model. But what Sully seems to have really understood, and the two paintings by Rebecca Gratz that Carol just mentioned, this Philadelphia sitter and philanthropist who was a normal person, so to speak. She wasn't an actress. But Sully understood that people play different parts, not just if your job is to be an actor and actress, but just as we, I think, would understand it today, you're different people at different times in different facets of your life.
Interesting.
He also seems to, and now as I think about the exhibit, and as I read today that women and children used to come to him to have their portrait done, there were some just totally absorbing and beautiful pictures of women and children. It seemed to be, am I right in saying, a specialty of his? He was really good at it.
Yes. Well, I think also because he had so many children of his own, and he had daughters growing up, four or five daughters growing up at the same moment in the house, so that, you know, they were all swirling around their father, and he paints them beautifully because he saw how they behaved. He knew what their expressions were. portraits typically of mothers and children have little details of the children touching the mother's hand in certain ways, of these kind of connections of shoes and socks falling off feet, so that you can have on one hand a very elegant portrait, something that's just very beautifully designed and is going to look gorgeous in your parlor, but you also have this human connection. So it's both a work of art, and yet it's warm, you know, and it's approachable, and it's about life and living, and that it's alive in that way. Mm-hmm. And these paintings are performing for us visually, and they're performing for us sort of emotionally.
It's happening in front of you,
yes.
So to speak. The,
mm-hmm.
the portrait is mm-hmm. happening in front of you. In that moment when you look at it, that person suddenly comes alive.
Mm-hmm.
The child kicks off a shoe, mm-hmm. or it's the way the body is turning, or the way someone is looking at you and sort of saying, look at me, here I am. Mm-hmm. It's a very dynamic encounter between the viewer of the picture and the picture itself, very much like, to beat the dead horse, very much like the effect of an actor or actress on a stage needs an audience, and the
yes.
audience completes the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And Sully just had to have, we're convinced he understood that
right.
so deeply. Without question, it was just the way he was brought up
yeah.
to think that this is the way
yeah.
the world works.
So often these figures that reach out into space, it's like they're reaching for the viewer. It's like, come to me.
Yeah. How did he learn how to paint? How do you know you can paint?
He had a variety of teachers of varying durations.
Very varying.
his longest teacher was his older brother, Lawrence, who was an artist, not a particularly good artist. Sully was a better artist than his brother.
Yes, yeah.
But Lawrence gave him the foundation. And then he had two brief periods of instruction with much more famous American artist, John Trumbull.
Very brief.
Very brief. And then Gilbert Stuart in Boston. Sully went to Boston for a few days to basically fetch and carry for Stuart, as mm-hmm. one did. And Stuart gave him very typically Stuart colorful and potentially contradictory advice, which was,
well, he says, keep all you have and get all you can get.
So and that's, you know, and that's the philosophy summed up in those words. But Sully also had two very life-changing trips back to his native England, because he had been born in England and come over as a child with his parents, because his parents were brought over to run a theatrical company. So when Sully's a young man, he goes back to England for 9 months, and then he goes again about 20 years later
to paint
Queen Victoria. And both times he looks at contemporary art, he makes sure he meets contemporary artists. And in this first trip, when he's a young man in the first decade of the 19th century, he actually attends courses at the Royal Academy, and particularly he studies with the Anglo-Swiss painter
yeah.
Heinrich Henry Fuseli.
Hmm.
And you see that for the rest of his career,
yep.
these interesting bodies in motion and serpentine postures. So Sully's education really was kind of a hybrid affair. And it's amazing what he did with it, considering that there wasn't a long, consistent period of training, mm-hmm. as we might expect from artists.
Yeah. He had a great deal of raw talent, which I think is what Stuart was getting at. And he sort of selectively pulled from the British tradition. You have to think of Sully within that tradition and how he invented from it, making his own expression out
of these. About a big get to paint Queen Victoria was a big deal. How did that happen?
It's a wonderful story. Sully was going to go to England to look at contemporary art, and a charitable organization in Philadelphia said, well, if you're there, we want you to paint the Queen. Because everybody's interested in painting the Queen. She's very young. She's 21, and she's ascending to the throne.
Just ascending.
And the Queen does not like to be painted, that must be said. And everyone's running after her. So Sully takes his daughter Blanche, who is also 21, same age as Queen Victoria, to England and tries to get the Queen's attention. And it doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen, and it doesn't happen. And this, by the way, was the story of a wonderful book and focus show that
yes.
Carrie Rebora Barrett, a superstar curator at the Met did at the turn of the 21st century.
Oh, interesting.
She tells it very well, very delightfully. And eventually, the Queen consented to deign to have Sully paint her, and we show the sketch from life that Sully did, and it really comes about through Fanny Kemble, who is represented in our
show. Oh, that actress, right. So all these, you know, because Fanny is British. British and Earth, and so you have all these interrelationships going. And one of
and the Queen's a fan.
Yeah.
And, oh, it's great.
Right. So this is perfect. And the interesting thing, Matt, as William mentioned, about his daughter being there and being the same age, I mean, not only could he sort of relate to this young queen, but when the queen was too busy learning how what statecraft was and wanting to ride her horse in the park and all these other things she had to do, he got his daughter to pose with the crown jewels, which Victoria allowed her to do. It's like, okay, I'm going to go off and do this.
You're my stand-in.
You can wear that. And the problem was it was extremely heavy on her head, and it was not as much fun as you might think it was, but it was sort of a great moment. And it showed the kind of way that Sully could deal with patrons. He had very nice personality. He got along very well with patrons and very well with all of his peers. You know, people did not have a bad word to say about Sully, but it was very innate to him. You know, it was not put on.
You read in Sully's journal that he keeps. It's quite wonderful. The Queen and Blanche have a rapport. They're both 21, and they chat like young girls about the things that young girls like, about fashion, about this and that. And
she brings her dogs.
Yeah, and it means that Blanche is the only American ever to have worn the crown jewels. And for an artist's daughter from Philadelphia, that's quite
an
accomplishment.
Quite a story. The other thing that amazed me, so many things did, but I was just amazed how quickly he did some of these portraits. You'd think that he would labor over them for years. Yeah. Some were done in a matter of weeks.
Well, yes. He had a very strong, you know, I think once he had a very strong vision of what he wanted to do, he knew how to apply that. And to some extent, he was working off templates from British portrait painting that he made his own. So the idea of inventing from something great in tradition, that's still wonderful because you recreate by doing that. And that was a very accepted practice at the time. But it certainly facilitated his process. And I think he also painted quickly. After a certain point, he was very self-assured and he knew where to
You see that in the handling.
And that's the performance.
That's also another
too.
Performance theatricality aspect, because in some of the canvases when you come to the show, as we very much want you to do, you'll see these great sort of flourishy brush strokes and even into the background, just moments of where he's dashed on color. And there's a tactility to it and an exuberance and a vibrancy. So he's performing across the surface, the marks he makes as well. He works quickly and he's a godsend to art historians because he kept very detailed records. So as you pointed out, Kathleen, we do know and we're able to include on the labels when he began a work and when he completed it. And a lot of the time visitors do ask when you give tours of a gallery, they'll say, well, how long did it take to make things? And a lot of the time we say, well, as long as it took, because we don't always know. We know, for example, that Gilbert Stuart, the American painter of an earlier generation, was notoriously slow. We know that John Singleton Copley, the colonial artist, was notoriously slow because we have letters of people complaining about how slow it was.
Or they didn't have the will to finish, which is very different with Sully, who was very businesslike in his dealings. And, you know, we not only do we have registers with things in, with dates, we also have prices valued. Whether he received that money or not, he valued what his time was worth and what those materials cost him. And so, therefore, you know, this was he had a very clear head about it.
Now, he was doing painting. I'm just interested in the times in which he lived. Times were tough economically, 1830s, 1840s in America, right?
So, absolutely.
Yeah.
So he probably didn't make a whole lot of money, at least for good chunks of his life. Did he ever? And did he have to adapt what he painted to the times in some way?
Yes. And that's where we bring our fancy pieces in, or these imaginative subject pictures, which are based on either the works of other famous artists, which, you know, would be appealing to people if he would copy them, but then make them a little different, perhaps more colorful or more decorative in some way. Or from literature, like he painted Little Nell asleep in the old curiosity shop as Dickens is getting off the boat from London, and his old curiosity shop became just a wonder of to people in America. They wanted to know the last installment. Did Little Nell die? Is she alive? What's going on? So this was very topical. He was painting to things of the moment, literature of the moment, of the day. That was not an old traditional text at the time. It was a new text. So he was very aware. What's going to sell? What's going to market? How's my name going to get out? Can I get a patron to buy this? A lot of it was speculative painting, William.
Sully keeps records, and so you can see that as there are bank panics and financial reversals in the late 1830s into the 1840s, and we've certainly lived through a lot of those in the last 5 years, the portrait market gets hit hard because people have less money to spend and they don't want to spend it on portraiture.
Yeah.
So Sully ramps up the production of subject pictures, and he is casting about for things. Why not a fairy tale or maybe a scene from Shakespeare? Or if that doesn't work, let's try James Fenimore Cooper, an older artist, or let's try Robinson Crusoe. So it's fascinating because I think viewers of today, one way into the show for them, when they go to look at the subject pictures, is to think about that these are the responses of an artist to the challenges of making a living. Because portraiture isn't often a repeat business. It's kind of one and done for most of
them. Hang it up and there it is.
And so here is an artist who made a living for nearly seven decades as an artist. I wouldn't say he was ever financially well off. It seems like it was always a bit of a struggle. Mm-hmm. He always had to be frugal. He always had to have an eye on the bottom line, but he persevered.
They lived well enough with, you know, without being overindulgent in anything.
They had love. They had a good family. They liked each other.
Right.
So one of those pictures, which is an important one in this collection, is the Cinderella picture.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Full disclosure, that was the first acquisition I ever made as a curator.
Was it really?
It was. Aww. You never forget your first time, so to speak. And I still have fond memories of Cinderella. It was truly a magical painting to acquire. I fell in love with it. And it's a joy to have it back with me, to have her back for 12 and a half weeks. And I talked to the painting. But the story of the painting is a very large picture of Cinderella at the kitchen fire. Her stepsisters are primping in the background, and she's in the foreground. This is pre-fairy godmother. She is dressed in rags, although for Sully they're very beautiful rags.
Very nicely colored rags.
And it's the moment before the fairy godmother is going to come in and work the magic to send her to the ball. And Sully chooses that moment very deliberately because the viewer is going to know how the story plays out, and it's that moment right before the magic happens. So it's full of tension.
I know what's going to happen.
No,
exactly.
It's great. It is a very magical.
It's a big painting. It's 50 by 58, which is quite large.
Yes.
Sully whips it out.
And horizontal. And so it's sort of cinematic.
Exactly.
That. It spreads across. Yeah.
Exactly. And he whips it out in roughly 2 months, which is fast for a very large painting like that, using his daughter as the model, and immediately starts shipping it around to try to display it in public and interest a buyer or someone in engraving it. And it's a marvelous, marvelous painting. And it's totally done as a way of trying to keep his brand before the public and find a subject that's going to be popular. And, of course, Cinderella was popular in the 19th century.
So
but so was Charles
painting.
Dickens.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
was
right.
Robinson Crusoe.
Right.
This is a man with his finger on the pulse of popular culture. Mm-hmm. But I do love the painting, and I hope people will come in and fall in love with her, too, and talk to her. She likes being talked to.
And the cat.
And there's a cat in it, and the cat likes to be talked to.
Why did you follow all the paintings? Why, when you say you fall in love with a picture, what does that mean to somebody like you who's studied all of this, who's got a PhD in art history? What does it mean?
Oh, it means exactly that. There's something about the picture. It's the story or the handling. Sometimes it's bound up with things in one's own personal life, like the situation you were in when you first saw something. So like anything else, the same way that any viewer falls in love with a picture, there's something, whether you see it in a museum or you have a reproduction of something even, or a picture that you grew up looking at in your parents' home, whatever. There's something about an image,
that you love.
It makes you happy.
Right.
And then when you see it again, it makes you remember ways you felt the last time you saw it, or the first time.
Yeah, well, that's what art's about. It's this relational thing, and Sully so deeply knew that.
Yeah.
And do you have a painting like that in this collection too, Carol?
Well, I probably do. I have a few. I love the portrait of Sarah Sully with the dog Ponto, which is the older.
He was a great dog painter.
He was a great dog.
He's unsung as a dog painter.
Come see the dogs and cats.
Exactly.
Really. It's a nice touch.
No, I love the Sarah Sully. I find it a very interesting mixture of his great skills. That his portrait of his wife when she's like in her, maybe in her late 50s or something like that, and she's sitting in a rocking chair. She's raised her children. She has this dog that's been left by her son that she's taking care of. She's sort of, you know, feeding him out of, you know, off her hand, but not paying attention to feeding him sort of automatically. And her head is thrown back, and she's, you know, you can just tell she's thinking. He's given her a face that is contemplative, that seems to dream. And it's just, it's a very, and that that it's reinforced by what he puts around her. It's large, like a fancy aristocratic grand manner painting, but this is not an aristocratic painting. This is a woman, American woman, in a rocking chair in a black silk dress. She's lost a number of children. Some of her children are still alive, but she has these memories. And it's he puts her in both a physical world with things like the rocking chair and the dog and the dog biscuit. And then he puts these beautiful flowers next to her, and then a background that's not really realistic, that's sort of just color and so forth. So she's suspended between the material world and the world of fleetingness, of dream, of memory. And it, you know, that's what Sully can do. Most portrait painters can't do all that.
Yeah, that was a great description.
And give you a likeness.
Right. We're going to welcome calls. I know that many of you haven't seen it, if any of you, because it hasn't really opened yet. It's going to open this Friday. But we're talking with the co-curators of the Thomas Sully exhibit, which is at the Milwaukee Art Museum now and runs through when?
January 5th.
Thank you. January 5th. It's called Painted Performances, and it's really just beautiful. So if you want to, I'll give you the phone number. You can join our conversation if you have questions about him, or who knows, there may be some of you listening who know a whole lot about Thomas Sully. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The co-curators of the Thomas Sully painted performance painting exhibition, which is at the Milwaukee Art Museum right now, are our guests this hour, William Rudolph and Carol Eaton Soltis. And if you want to join, I won't press the phone number because I know you haven't seen the exhibit yet, but you're welcome to join the conversation if you have questions about him. 800-486-8655. Before we talk more about Sully, I'm just interested in this whole process of spending 8 years on a project. Because, I mean, it's a big thing to get to select the paintings, to figure out if somebody's going to let you take one of the paintings for a while, the negotiation process, writing a book. This is a large part of both of your lives.
Yes, actually, Carol and I have realized in an amazed way that when the project started, I had an infant niece who is now in third grade.
Oh.
And Carol is about to have her first grandchild, and her daughter wasn't married.
No, so we've really sort of, you know, gone way beyond. Yes.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend spending 8 years on a project or choose the project. Choose a project you're going to really like, because it's a long time.
But it takes time to launch things sometimes,
exactly,
you know, and
exactly.
It doesn't always fit the moment, and, you know, you move or you do something or what happens. And
but it's a long, complicated – any exhibition, putting together an exhibition, is a long and complicated process. And basically, we talked about – first we had to figure out what we were thinking about Sully. What is this notion of theatricality?
Which has changed over time.
Exactly.
It's evolved. So time is not bad.
Yeah. And what works would best suit this? And there are well-known works and lesser-known works. And as you alluded to earlier, Kathleen, there's a fair amount of digging one has to do, and we did it. And then there are the negotiations of, can you get the works? And there are works that we wanted that we didn't get for reasons of either condition or – there's always this kind of thing in the loan process.
Sure.
And ultimately what comes together is there is a product of research, of negotiation, of trial and error, of trust.
Trust,
and
yes.
Great,
well,
and
yes.
Great collegiality, mm-hmm. not just among each – among the curatorial team, but with other colleagues and institutions.
So they can help you along with things.
Exactly.
And, you know, you really but it's been a pleasure for me to work with William, and he's, you know, been a very generous colleague, and it's excellent. I think you don't always have that kind of synergy.
Right.
And it's been a very good experience.
Were you both Thomas Sully aficionados?
Well,
did you know each other? How did
we met when William was at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
Oh, okay.
And before, we just started talking one day. Well, you're one of those other people that like Thomas Sully. And then we started talking about fancy pictures, these imaginative pictures that he did. and nobody likes them, and nobody knows about them. So we thought we had found, you know, we had found each other. Yeah. So, you know, there we go. You know, the rest is history.
We're not alone. And the thing is that Carol and I both love 18th and 19th century American art and have each worked on other aspects of it. And we both like Thomas Sully, but honestly, this was a voyage of education for both of us about this artist, because neither one of us worked on him, for example, in graduate school.
Right.
He had not been the focus of previous research that we had done. We had
That's
each kind of gone around him.
I knew him because his friend Rembrandt Peale, who he had known from the time he moved to Philadelphia in 1808 until Peale's death in 1860, I've worked on him for many years and done major research and publications on him. So it was sort of like I had read about Thomas Sully or read Thomas Sully's mail to Rembrandt Peale and so on and so forth, and I knew what he was up to with this and that and the other thing. And so we have a picture of Rembrandt Peale that Sully painted in the show. But, you know, it was sort of this backhanded around thing. And then you think, well, if I know this about Peale, gee, maybe I can translate that into something about Sully and also how they were so different. You know, it became interesting. There was a community that you could dive into.
And this was one of the things that was great for us, because as scholars of portraiture, we, in order to figure out what Sully was doing, we often had wonderful conversations about what he wasn't doing compared to artists we knew better. In Carol's case, the entire Peale family. And for me, someone like John Singleton Copley, who I know a little bit about, or Gilbert Stuart or other artists, some of my freaky Louisiana 19th century, which was my training, freaky 19th century Louisiana people rejecting Sully and the Northeast and embracing France. Oh. So these were fun conversations that I think deepened our knowledge of the 19th century. And of course, both being Philadelphians, Sully is imbricated in that city. You can't really take a step in Philadelphia in any cultural institution or down to hospitals, universities, libraries without running into a work by Sully, because he lived there for so long.
And was prolific.
So it also helped us make sense of our own city's past.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. He was very much a part of it, and, you know, involved with lots of institutions. I mean, you know, his theatricality extended to his love of music. He was one of the founders of the Musical Society in Philadelphia, you know, and so he was involved in the cultural life of the city, not as a leader, because he never wanted to be head of something. He wanted his sort of private life and his ability to pursue his art and be with his family, but, you know, he was very, very implicated.
Absolutely, and as a matter of fact, he turned down, for example, he was asked to be the president of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, which is the nation's oldest surviving art school and museum, and Sully turned it down. He did not want that kind of public role, but he showed there most of his life. Mm-hmm. And I have come away from this project realizing that I really can't think about 19th century American art without thinking about Sully in some respect. At times when he was in the mainstreams, and at times, quite frankly, when he was absolutely different from what was going on. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I think, in a lovely way textured my understanding when I will teach the 19th century or present other exhibitions. Sully's changed the way I think about things.
Hmm. Oh, interesting. And what about this, the issues that he was dealing with? You mentioned that they were hard economic times. Were there other social issues?
Yes.
I mean, it's interesting that he did it. Dickens obviously was into social issues.
Right.
Did he share a similar perspective on the economy, on the downtrodden? What caught his paintbrush?
Well, I think one of the things was children. And you mentioned before his wonderful portraits of mothers and children and so forth. And the vulnerability of children is a sort of subtext theme within his work, and he deals with that both in his imaginative pictures and sometimes in his portraiture. We have a picture in the show of Miss Hindman of Maryland dressed up like Little Red Riding Hood. While on the one hand, this was sort of thing that would happen in London, someone might be painted in costume. It was something he particularly embraced, and of course, it's a beautiful picture. It's, you know, talk about performing on canvas with paint. I mean, wow, it's really something, and it's basically a life-size picture of this little girl. But it's also a picture of childhood vulnerability. And then he takes another picture, which is an imaginative picture, which is not specific, does not have a specific sitter, but it's a girl on the seashore. And she is putting her foot in, and the wind is whipping around, and the adults are going up a bluff, and they're paying no attention to her. And this taps into the concerns in society at that time that the children weren't being properly looked after, that parents were not vigilant enough, and so on and so forth. And it was commissioned by a doctor in Philadelphia who was of that mind about things. And so it's interesting, but it's very much in reformist people's mind. And a woman, Lydia Sigourney, who was an editor and a sort of poetess, saw the picture when it was exhibited at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and she decided she was going to write a poem about it. So the painting came first. The poem came later. It ends up in a publication designed for a upper middle class audience called A Gift Book, which comes out annually. And there is an engraving of Sully's painting with Lydia's narrative next to it, this poetic narrative. And Sully's painting is a little ambiguous. I mean, the child is clearly, in a dangerous situation, but Lydia kills her off in the poem. And, she drowns.
Terrible.
Well, yes, but she was trying to make this point that, if you don't watch your children, this can befall them. And it's the whole idea that a lot of European scholars are now looking more at sentimentality in the 19th century as not something like, ooh, ick, I don't want to get near that sentimentality, but rather as a social reform
movement. What does this mean when we see a painting?
Right, when we see this, when a child is suffering, when this is happening, and this child is in danger, and we actually have a little, as William likes to say, our room of frightened children.
They're sleeping, or are they sleeping? They've been awakened from sleep, and they look afraid to go back to sleep. They're lost. Right. They might wander
into
falling.
The sea. Falling.
It's a tense room. It's a beautiful room and a tense room.
Talk about action.
Yeah. there is a theme of the lost child that Sully goes back to again and again and again throughout his career. So it's obviously preying on his mind that things can happen.
Right, things can happen. And the color, we should talk about the use of color, because I don't know what an artist does, but they are just beautiful. They're Rembrandt-like to me in a way. The skin and the hair and the faces, they're just really luscious.
He managed light and color beautifully. He loved to have like a light flooding in over a face or coming in over a shoulder. It was a dynamic compositional device. Light plays a role in these pictures,
but it's also like a spotlight from the wings or from out in the audience.
Yeah.
It's like theatrical lighting.
Look
there is
now.
Someone
it
who's adjusting
something.
A light mm-hmm. onto the figure to pick that out of the darkness.
And rich colors, as you say, very rich, and then nuanced colors. It's not like he could just do a bright scarlet or a deep blue or something. We were looking at a picture like 2 hours ago. We were saying, look at that strip
of color.
Look at
the little bit of blue and green.
And you step back and it all kind of comes together. But wow, when you get close to it, it's like, an abstract expressionist painting. These surfaces are not like, just the paint is moving around in different colors. And it's quite wonderful. You can look at them on many levels.
And is it unusual to have a major artist, I mean, he was a big deal in the 19th century, to not have a retrospective of his work for 30 years?
I think, to us it seemed like a crying shame. It was a great opportunity. We're actually glad now in retrospect because it allowed us to do the show. But it struck us as unusual and strange that Sully hadn't had more attention. And I have to think that it comes from two things. One is that people are often uncomfortable with portraiture shows.
Really?
They're wonderful, but sometimes the powers that be at museums, if they think that someone's they're a little afraid that it's just going to be images of dead people, so to speak. But I also think that the fancy pictures made 20th century audiences uncomfortable. They didn't know how to deal with the sentiment. They'd lost the context that Carol describes of what these things might have done. They'd lost the stories behind the novels, except for the Shakespearean scenes.
Oh, goodness.
These are now obscure novels, or some of the plays are obscure. And a lot of these works were relegated to storerooms. They just weren't
shown.
Yeah,
I found one in a coat room in a library.
Exactly.
Unbelievable.
And so I think that combination, honestly, it coincided with the rise of modernism, where no one wanted to look at, talk about, or think about things that might have been your grandmother's or great-grandmother's. And Sully's great exuberance and his blossoming and his style could easily be misunderstood because it did not seem to lead inexorably towards abstraction and towards the heroics of modernism. Right. So I think Sully just fell victim to changing taste in the 20th century mm-hmm. and an overall discomfort with what do you do with over 2,000 works, many of which, 90% of which are portraits. Do you mm-hmm. think that's fair, Carol?
Yeah, and also that the oeuvre is very large. You know, his body of work is very large, and there sometimes will come on the market things that are not of the quality that we have in the show. We have sort of the creme de la creme of things in the show. And so sometimes people, I think, were confused. Is that Sully? Is that something that his daughter painted, you know, that was coming on? So, you know, for any artist, and especially these 19th century artists who struggled through difficult economic times, they were painting on demand, and not every painting is as gorgeous or as perfect. And so mm-hmm. the understanding of this totality of his work, you know, you have to sort of accept it, and you have to say, we're going after Sully at his peak, at his best, as what his vision was, and we're showing you the best of the best. Every, you know, all artists are right. like that. Right. And we all know we don't consistently perform at the same level every day in every endeavor that we do. And whatever,
is it unusual to have, 2,700 works? Isn't that unusual for a painter?
He's busy.
He was prolific. He was really, really busy. And, you know, to piggyback on what Carol just said and to think about the number of works that he recorded, which is not the total number of works.
There are more out there.
I think Sully was also penalized in the 20th century for having been too prolific and too popular. We like the idea, right. We like the modern idea of the tortured artist who starves. And though Sully certainly always had to be aware of where the money was coming from, he doesn't seem to have been particularly tortured. He was a happy family man with lots of friends.
Everybody thoughtful, but not tortured.
Everybody thought well of him. Mm. He was well loved. He was normal. And in the 20th century, we liked people looking backwards
abnormal.
In our field. We liked people like antisocial Winslow Homer in Maine, or we liked Thomas Aikens, who was always getting into trouble in Philadelphia. I think that has to factor into the fact that Sully was too popular in his own day. He was too normal. He was too well settled, even though some of the works are unsettling. Mm-hmm. And I just think that
people
there was
never looked hard enough to figure out they were unsettling.
Yeah, there was a kind of a perfect storm
against that he would flatter people.
Yes.
But that's
part
to
of the
great
job.
Extent. Yeah, it's part of the job. But it was also not understanding what he was trying to accomplish in a portrait, which was often really subtle with it. But it is a perfect storm.
Let's go to a phone call. Sarah is calling us from Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Gosh, you were saying hi. You were talking about the freaky Louisiana painters and how they didn't like him, and I couldn't quite catch what you said, but I heard France, and I'm wondering, was there like a French style that the Louisiana people were following and they didn't like the American style? And then was there a rivalry between English and French painting? And then when did Paris become the center of the art world?
Okay.
It's a big question. It's a wonderful question. Very, very briefly, there's a tradition of art that develops in the southern United States, particularly in Louisiana, over the course of the 19th century, which is very strongly identified with the type of paintings that were made in France. So the brushwork is very precise. There's an overall kind of cold tonality. And it's very different from the types of works that Sully did in the Northeast and many of his contemporaries. And one of the things that I've argued in my career is that there was a very deliberate adoption of a French style in places like Louisiana to look like European art, but French European art, rather than to look like Anglo art of any sort, which is playing out due to tensions after the Louisiana Purchase and what we call the Americanization of Louisiana. That's kind of the answer in a nutshell, that people, the sort of Francophones, were choosing to look French rather than choosing to look British, which also meant to look like Boston, to look like Philadelphia, to look like New York, to look like the whole sort of school that Sully is a part of and also extending, because Sully's so prolific that even if people don't see his works, they see other artists imitated him at the same time. So that there was a moment where this choice was being deliberately made in a world that had a different cultural background. Paris as the center of the art world is really, it's been that off and on.
Yeah, but there was also an issue in Philadelphia. Of, I mentioned before, one of Sully's closest friends, Rembrandt Peale, who goes off to Paris in 1808, comes back home, goes back to Paris in 1809, and stays there for a year. And he comes back with a style that is not like Stuart, which is what Sully's style is, but a very neoclassical style that he derives from the French neoclassical painters of that time. And he kind of keeps that with him, but that's not typical, and it didn't sell the way Sully's style sold, because it wasn't as exciting, and he had a very different kind of career, got more into doing very large-scale history paintings, and just never, it was a totally different personality, of course, but it was just sort of a niche thing. But I think a lot of the people that were around Sully were influenced by Sully in Philadelphia, with a kind of mixture between something that was a little more controlled, perhaps a little closer to that more linear sculptural style of French, and then the more painterly style of the British. So it's interesting, and there are representations, but you know, he deliberately went for the Anglo style, and it is Sully, and it is the basis of his work.
Thanks, Sarah, very much for the call. We're spending this hour talking about the exhibit, which will open this Friday at the Milwaukee Art Museum, Thomas Sully Painted Performance. And we'll continue in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us for a few more minutes here on the Ideas Network, Carol Eaton-Soltis, who is Project Associate Curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Center for American Art. She is co-curator of the Thomas Sully exhibit we've been talking about, as is William Rudolph, who is Dudley Godfrey Jr., Curator of American Art and Decorative Arts and Director of Exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum. I always like, before too much time, because we're running short, but I always like to highlight some of the lectures that take place, because they're always creative and they're an added dimension to the exhibit that you're seeing. One, I think, is on Shakespeare, isn't it?
Yes.
Oops, let me get your mic on. Go ahead.
Yes, the first Thursday of November, the first Thursday of December, and the first Thursday of January, which is Target First Free Thursday, so you can come to the museum for free thanks to Target. And at 6:15 on those three Thursdays, we'll have a lecture. The first one is from a professor of English at the University of South Dakota, Darlene Farabee, who is a Shakespeare scholar, and she's going to talk to us about how Shakespeare's plays were performed in Sully's day, and how his audience would have understood it. Then the second one, Carol, will be back.
Oh, great. Stay away from Milwaukee. And that's going to be on Thomas Sully's affective portraiture, the traditions of affective portraiture, which is sort of what we've been talking about a little, but I'm going to push harder for it in the historic context of what he was relating to.
And then finally, the first Thursday in January, right before we close, Anna Marley from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, a dear friend of both Carol's and mine, is going to come from Philadelphia and kind of give us the Philadelphia portrait world of Sully's day, how he is and is not like many of his colleagues. So we hope that you'll join us. As I said, it's absolutely free, whether you're a member or not. Thank you, Target, at 6:15 in Lubar Auditorium. And we hope that those lectures help bring the exhibition alive in different ways for our visitors.
Yeah, they're great to have. Great to have. We missed one of the, speaking of audiences understanding Shakespeare and seeing Shakespeare during that time, the huge portrait and the story behind this one is interesting. What's the actor's name?
George
He's playing
Frederick
Richard
Cook.
III.
Yeah, it's Richard III, yeah.
It's one of Sully's earliest paintings. It's his first great public success.
Yeah.
It's life-size. Famous British actor who's working in Philadelphia in his signature role of Richard III, delivering one of Richard III's evil famous monologues.
Yeah. So he looks very evil.
He
in
looks
the picture.
Very
yeah.
evil and very beautifully
yeah.
evil. And Sully was commissioned to paint it by friends who were managers of a theater in Philadelphia and actors themselves. Here's the family connection. And the good thing for Sully, bad thing for George Frederick Cook is that Cook dies shortly after the painting is completed of cirrhosis. He lived well and hard.
Yes.
And so the portrait becomes a runaway success, and it really helps make Sully's career.
Yeah, because and it becomes it's a notoriety. You know, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
just like today, all publicity is good publicity. And this is the picture that actually greets visitors to the show. You see where it all begins, so to speak.
Isn't it something that it's always a story, and it may be the oddest story that can propel somebody's career? And that is quite a story.
Yes, it is. It really.
Yeah. All right, the Nitty Gritty again. It opens Friday of this week.
If you're a member of the museum, members preview is tomorrow, October 10th. If you're not yet a member, show up after 10 a.m. and we will happily sign you up for, as a membership. But it is open to the public October 11th through January 5th. Remember, the first Thursdays of November, December, and January are all free, Target First Free Thursdays, and kids 12 and under are free every day.
Wonderful. That's great. And it goes from here to Texas?
Yes, to the San Antonio Museum of Art, who own the magnificent portrait of Sarah Sully that Carol was talking about.
Oh.
It travels there from February through May. See it both places.
The more the merrier.
And you've had to go all over to collect these, or have they been centrally located, most in Philadelphia or not?
No, they're really from all over the country.
All over the country, and
Europe. We have Oxford University Art Museum, the Ashmolean. We have one coming.
And the Royal College of Music in London. Two from Great Britain. We have works from the West Coast, from the South, from the Southeast, from Colorado.
Portland, Maine. LA.
Massachusetts. Yeah, and a lot from Philadelphia, because that is the locus of Sully.
Yeah.
So Philadelphia is well represented.
Thank you both so much. It was just really an interesting hour. I hope people see the exhibit, because it's terrific. And thanks for all the hard work and getting us so involved. I feel like we've been through all these stories this hour. It's great.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks to William Rudolph and Carol Eaton Soltis, and they are the co-curators of Thomas Sully Painted Performance. I have a picture of Thomas Sully. He actually looks like he's a good-looking guy. He's got character in his face, too. Somebody, a lot of character. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks for all of your calls. We're with you again tomorrow. One of our guests tomorrow is the author of Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Thanks for listening. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.